Hello, kings and queens of the ring. Welcome back to another episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Poyo Del Mar. I am your host, Poyo Del Mar, the first lady of professional wrestling, your wrestling-obsessed drag personality. I am a reporter and journalist with the Huffington Post, having covered professional wrestling for the last many years on Huffington Post, and I have been a lifelong fan of professional wrestling. It is a joy and a pleasure for you to join me each and every week as I recap the big three televised broadcasts of our favorite professional wrestling shows, Raw, SmackDown, and of course Impact Wrestling, as well as to bring you fun and in-depth interviews with our favorite professional wrestling superstars. This episode, updating us on the return of Season 4 of Lucha Underground, another of our favorite televised products, which I will hopefully be covering on a regular basis as it returns for Season 4, we have the queen herself of the Serpent Tribe. Miss Cobra Moon is going to be joining us. I had the opportunity to work with Cobra Moon on a recent Wrestling for Charity show here in San Francisco. She is a native of the San Francisco Bay Area and also wrestles under the name Thunder Rosa on the indie circuit. She currently lives in Texas, where she runs an all-women's promotion known as Sabotage. She will be on later this episode to talk intergender matches, the return of Lucha Underground, as well as developments and advances in the world of women's professional wrestling. This episode of Arm Drag Takedown is being recorded on Thanksgiving itself. So before I move forward, I do want to take a moment and thank each and every one of you who has tuned in. In a moment of disclosure, I reached out to friends of mine in a Facebook group that is dedicated to LGBTQ fans of professional wrestling, and I asked if there was a place and or room at the table, so to speak, for an LGBTQ-focused podcast relating to wrestling. And while I bill this podcast as having a quote-unquote queer twist, all that really means to me is that as a member of the LGBTQ community who has long been a fan of professional wrestling, I haven't always felt that my perspective has been reflected on other podcasts. I don't think that LGBTQ fans have a very different perspective overall on professional wrestling, but I do think that we are not represented in media and or voices that reflect the appreciation for professional wrestling as a form of entertainment. I recently, in fact, received a tweet that suggested that because of the fact that I am a drag performer, I watch wrestling for, quote, all the wrong reasons. And I don't know what those suspected reasons are. I'm guessing that the individual who tweeted that, besides just simply being ignorant, thinks that I watch wrestling because the guys are hot. Well, maybe there's a part of that, but I don't think that there's a straight man out there who watches professional wrestling who does not admire the women based on their beauty. And let's not forget the women who watch who can appreciate how attractive the men are as well. However, is that really the only reason that any of us watches? If the beauty or the sex appeal of a performer is the only reason that any one of us would watch professional wrestling, then that, in fact, is absolutely, undeniably the wrong reason. I, however, have been watching professional wrestling since I was 8 years old. I'm 44 now. And I have long loved the storytelling, the larger-than-life characters, the obvious showmanship, and simply the athleticism that is shown in the ring. So I believe, in reality, members of the LGBTQ community, such as myself, watch professional wrestling for the same reasons everyone else does. We simply love wrestling. So to all of you who have tuned in and to each of the superstars who have joined me so far on our first 6 episodes, thank you so much for allowing me to express and live my professional wrestling-related dreams through talking to each and every one of you on a weekly basis. Thank you for tuning in. I look to bring you a quality product here every episode, as well as to speak with some of our favorite, collective favorite superstars. And that means whether you are a member of the LGBTQ community or not, you are certainly welcome. I do not think that my attitudes expressed here are going to be problematic for anyone. And with that said, for the 7,000 people plus who tuned in to my interview with Robbie E., thank you to the more than 5,300 people who have already tuned in to episode 6 with Austin Aries. Thank you, and thank you to anyone who has suggested this podcast to friends or others who love professional wrestling. For that, on Thanksgiving Day, I am extremely grateful. And now, let's recap the first episodes of Raw and SmackDown after the Survivor Series and the latest episode of Impact Wrestling. All of that and much, much more on this episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. To never miss an action-packed, celebrity-filled episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar, follow us on social media. Facebook can be found at ADT with PDM. And follow us on Twitter, also ADT with PDM. That's ADT with PDM. Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. We are back with more Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. First and foremost, it must be said that Survivor Series was a surprisingly good pay-per-view, one of the best pay-per-views that I've seen from the WWE in quite some time. Brock Lesnar versus AJ Styles was an amazing, amazing match, incredible match. I did not think necessarily that Brock would pick up a clean win over AJ as he did, but it was a great showing for both. It was a phenomenal showing, in fact, and I look forward to future opportunities to see these two face off. I don't know when that will happen again next, but AJ certainly looked strong in his showing. Brock, of course, proved to be extremely strong, obviously picking up the victory. Also, we got to see some surprising turns in the main event elimination match, wherein Triple H comes in, turns against Kurt Angle, allowing Shane to get a surprise pinfall over Kurt, only to turn around and pin his brother-in-law, Shane McMahon, which sets up a confrontation and conflict between Braun Strowman, who hoped to pick up the victory, and Triple H. It's going to be very interesting as we begin the road to the Royal Rumble, and then from there, the road to WrestleMania. Look for big things from Raw. All of those began playing out this episode of Raw as we kick things off with Stephanie McMahon in the ring to trumpet her husband's victory in that elimination match, which turns into a scenario where Kurt Angle runs to the ring, confronting Triple H, followed by Jason Jordan in the ring, confronting Triple H, followed by Braun Strowman in the ring, confronting Triple H. We have a huge multi-way confrontation between these men, which ultimately sees Triple H backing down from Braun Strowman and Stephanie making a match for later in the evening between Braun Strowman and Jason Jordan. Now, Jason Jordan, of course, is out there on Pride alone, and he is suggesting that he can take on Triple H. Stephanie says that Triple H will just destroy you, which I really do think is true, and sets this match up for later in the evening. That is promptly followed by an in-ring match that was set up at Survivor Series between Finn Balor and Samoa Joe. We have seen this confrontation before. We've seen it brewing for quite a while. These two were major rivals in NXT. And the thing that stood out to me about this is that Samoa Joe dominated Finn Balor in a way that I would not have expected. Yes, of course, Finn got in all kinds of offense, looked very good for himself, but ultimately Samoa Joe defeated Finn Balor in a way that I did not think was reflective of both of them being on equal footing in the company. Joe proved very, very dominant. Finn looked and played the underdog character in a way that I would not have expected in this confrontation. Ultimately, Joe picks up a victory with the Coquina Clutch, and even the announce team says that he basically pummeled Finn Balor. I'm not sure what this indicates for Finn's future going forward, and where, honestly, is this confrontation between Finn Balor and Bray Wyatt? Have they dropped that storyline? Have they dropped Sister Abigail? I am left wondering because we have not seen Sister Abigail in a number of weeks, and even though they made reference to him last week when Bray Wyatt, or I guess they made reference to her last week when Bray Wyatt faced off against Jason Jordan, this storyline seems to be one that they are possibly quite rapidly forgetting. Up next is a Miz TV segment where The Miz demands that The Shield thank him for helping reunite the group. It ultimately turns into a melee wherein The Miz's mouth gets him in a little bit of trouble. He says that no matter whether or not he lost to Baron Corbin on Sunday, which, by the way, whose idea was that? Baron Corbin is dead in the water. Just let it go. So The Miz says that regardless of whether or not he lost, he is still a champion and he's still got the Intercontinental title. One thing leads to another. The Shield beats down the Miztourage. Poor Curtis Axel constantly paying for the Miz's big mouth. He pays with a triple powerbomb on this night, and it sets up for a match between Roman Reigns versus The Miz for the Intercontinental title later in the evening. From there, we go to seeing Cesaro and Sheamus, the Raw Tag Team Champions, continuing this feud. Sheamus ultimately proves very, very effective in the match, but still picks up the loss. Dean Ambrose picks up Dirty Deeds while Sheamus is distracted by a brawl between Rollins and Cesaro outside the ring. I guess I'm not surprised that Sheamus loses in this, because were the champions to pick up a victory in one-on-one action, it would slow the challenger's momentum. And right now it appears Rollins and Ambrose are the top contenders for the belts, since they lost in dubious fashion a couple weeks ago as we moved towards SummerSlam. But ultimately, I just have to say this. I'm not a fan of Dean Rollins. I don't like the character they have him playing. I don't like the goofy character. I don't like it. It's not interesting or fun to me. I know that I really do believe, and I'm aware that I'm probably in the vast minority here. However, with that said, I do like Sheamus and Cesaro in ways that I would never have suspected when they teamed them together months and months ago. They've gelled very well as a team. They work very well as a team. They look good as a team. And so I'm appreciating them during their third reign as WWE Raw Tag Team Champions. Presumably, as we enter and move towards Royal Rumble, we're going to get to see more matches between The Shield, Rollins and Ambrose versus The Bar. I wouldn't be shocked if The Bar dropped the belts back to The Shield, but ultimately I would like to see The Bar continue as the champs, and I would like to see Seth Rollins freed from this madness. Alexa Bliss, the WWE Raw Women's Champion, off of her loss at SummerSlam to Charlotte Flair, is in the ring talking about just wasn't her night, she says. Meanwhile, she's interrupted by the top four contenders, apparently, to the women's title: Mickie James, Sasha Banks, Bayley, and the Raw Women's Captain for the Survivor Series match, Alicia Fox, who all say that they deserve a title shot. Well, something that's really worth note here is the crowd did not seem that into these women. They were mild at best, and I think that there's a reason for that. They have certainly played out these four different individuals as challengers, with the exception of Alicia Fox, who has only recently reemerged. She's got a great character. I'm quite into her character, honestly. She plays crazy quite well. Of course, what happens is that Kurt Angle sets up the four women in a four-way match to determine who the number one contender will be. And as everybody knows at this point, the big highlight of this episode really was the return of Paige to Raw television, wherein she debuts once again after a year away from the company. We all have followed her trials and tribulations as she has gotten into everything from legal disputes to sex tapes to whatever during her time away. It's been not the best year away from WWE for Paige, but she has been given a victorious return, and as she says, she did not come alone. Paige has apparently brought with her Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville from NXT. Many people know Mandy Rose from her appearances on Total Divas, but the three of them clean house, taking out all four contenders. And then during a post-match interview backstage, Alexa Bliss walks up to introduce herself to the women, only to be attacked, taken out. They slam her into everything in sight. They throw her into a pile of, I don't even know, containers, and then slam her into a wall and just give her a major beatdown. It looks like in one fell swoop, these three women are going to change the landscape of Raw. It set the internet on fire, and it really will liven things up in the women's division going forward towards Royal Rumble. It is time that Alexa Bliss has different challengers, so I appreciate and value this. Paige, as a returning former WWE Women's Champion, is a huge asset. Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville are going to be tremendous assets as well. Neither one of them are ready necessarily for the big title push, but fortunately, that's where Paige comes in. She's going to front this trio. What happens next is anyone's guess. It is going to be a welcome infusion of new life and energy into a division that has been lacking a bit of late. One thing that I could not help but notice is that nowhere in this madness was Nia Jax. Now, where is Nia Jax in this? Maybe it was because of the fact that they could not make it believable that even these three women would be able to take Nia out of the picture. But why Nia didn't come to the ring to begin with to stake her claim for an opportunity at the Women's Championship is beyond me. I certainly think she's more fitting for a championship opportunity than any of the four women that they presented. Sasha, Bayley, and Mickey have all been recently dispatched in terms of opportunities by Alexa, and Alicia Fox hasn't done anything worthy of note, per se, other than leading the women to victory at SummerSlam. But really, was that her doing, or was it Asuka? Earlier in the night, by the way, we did see Asuka beat Dana Brooks in a rather quick fashion. Dana is going to be forgotten in all of this turmoil. She has become the brand's enhancement talent, if you will, in the women's division. I really think that things are looking up for the women on Raw. Where this new trio takes us, I'm not sure. And where Nia Jax is going to factor in is something that I'm going to keep an eye out for. Nia is one of my favorites. I think she is a powerhouse, and I think she deserves an opportunity to run with that belt. She being on Total Divas is doing her good in terms of revealing a different side to her. And I also think that the body positive image that she reflects, she is fucking beautiful. Yes, she's a plus size woman. She's a large woman. And she can kick some ass, but she's gorgeous, you guys. This is coming from a drag queen who's not really watching because I'm sexually attracted to the women. I'm watching, and she is just a plain ass-kicking machine. So you go, Nia. You go, hunty. I love it. Up next is Jason Jordan finally facing off against Braun Strowman. Jason is on the verge of getting his ass handed to him when he has a knee injury, falls outside of the ring, and that's when Kane arrives out of nowhere to attack Braun Strowman with a chair. Remember, Braun put Kane through the mat last week, literally. The segment ends with Braun Strowman being hit in the throat with the steel chair and Kane leaving him as Braun is gasping for air. In the back, Braun refuses medical attention, further proving that he is a monster among men. Out next is Enzo Amore to talk about his Cruiserweight Championship and his victory over Kalisto at SummerSlam. As the 205 Live champion pumps up his Zoe train of Daivari De Niro, Drew Gulak, Tony Nese, and Noam Dar, they're confronted by other members of 205 Live, Rich Swann, Cedric Alexander, Akira Tozawa, and Ali Mustafa. Without question, it breaks into a complete brawl. And in the stupidest comment of the night, Michael Cole says, "I didn't see this one coming." And thank you, Booker T, for saying, "What? You didn't see this one coming? There's eight guys in the ring." It goes without saying that an eight-man tag team match is created during the break. And in the end, it comes out Rich Swann, Cedric Alexander, who, by the way, I think is so hot. Cedric Alexander, Akira Tozawa, and Ali Mustafa pick up the win when Mustafa pins Tony Nese. So apparently, though the Zoe train is there for Enzo, it's not getting them any closer to a victory on 205 Live. Up next, Matt Hardy confronts Elias. Elias barely ever gets to finish a song on the show. I'm just not a big fan of the songs. I am a fan of Elias, and Matt Hardy confronts him after the victory Elias scored over Matt at SummerSlam. We will see more of this as it continues. It's a great opportunity for Matt to while away some time while Jeff is recuperating. And Elias is going to do very well from having a ongoing series of matches against an established superstar like Matt. Capping the show is, in fact, the Intercontinental Championship match between Roman Reigns versus the champion, The Miz. As everybody already knows, Roman Reigns picks up the victory here, becoming a Grand Slam champion in WWE. My thoughts on this are really pretty divided. It goes beyond just not being a huge fan of Roman Reigns. It really centers around the idea that Roman Reigns is going to do nothing this for this Intercontinental title, and the Intercontinental title is going to do even less for Roman Reigns. Why has the WWE not seen fit to build a younger star up by putting him in a program with someone like The Miz and allowing that individual to pick up a victory over The Miz? It would do a tremendous amount to push somebody who is new or emerging as a talent to the next level, possibly closer to a main event level attraction by being in a program with The Miz over an extended period of time and ultimately picking up the belt at a marquee type event such as Royal Rumble. Roman Reigns does not need this belt. It doesn't do anything for him. And as a viewer, it doesn't do anything for me. As I said earlier in this podcast, I'm fully aware that my feelings about the Shield are in the minority. However, from a perspective of a wrestling viewer, having the Intercontinental Championship on Roman is going to do nothing positive that I can see at this time for anyone on the roster. All right, that is our arm drag takedown of Monday Night Raw. And now let's take a look at what's happening on SmackDown. Our arm drag takedown of the Blue Brand kicks off with Shane McMahon coming to the ring to talk about SmackDown's loss to Raw on SummerSlam. He's in the ring and he has said that he is proud of every single member of the SmackDown locker room, with the exception of two people, and he calls out Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens. And after an extended diatribe between the three men, he teases firing them, only to be cut off by Daniel Bryan, who enters the ring to announce a handicap match between The New Day and Owens and Zayn later in the evening. It's going to also be a lumberjack match. So the entire SmackDown roster will be around the ring as two men take on the three members of the New Day. That is coming up. It's going to be our main event. And we move then immediately into one-on-one match between Shelton Benjamin and half of the WWE SmackDown Tag Team Champions, the Usos. After Jimmy Uso picked up a pinfall victory over Chad Gable last week, this week it is Shelton Benjamin taking on Jey Uso as the team of Benjamin and Gable continue to forge on towards a future title match against the Usos, who at this point in time are running roughshod over the WWE tag team division. They picked up a pinfall over the bar on Sunday at SummerSlam. Benjamin is able to pull out a victory here over Jey, continuing momentum for the team, or reviving momentum for the team. And quite obviously, we will see more of Benjamin and Gable versus the Usos as we move forward. I personally was really hoping that, given the recent spat of call-ups from NXT, that the Authors of Pain would show up unexpectedly on this episode, setting up for the Usos versus Authors of Pain. People out there might be aware that the Usos have declared themselves the most dominant team in the industry today, and certainly within WWE, so I thought that the Authors of Pain might have something to say about that. Perhaps we'll get to see that in the future, but for now, we're stuck with Gable and Benjamin challenging the Usos. I'm not that interested in Gable and Benjamin, but I do think that at least they bring something new to the division. I think it's time that more teams are introduced, because there are no teams on the current SmackDown roster, aside from the New Day, who can challenge, convincingly challenge, at least the Usos for those belts. I wish that Breezango was in the mix, but they're just not. I guess that the debuting Bludgeon Brothers, who picked up a victory over the Hype Brothers later in this same show, could be considered contenders, but I don't see that the heel Bludgeon Brothers are going to be taking on the heel Usos. It just doesn't seem effective in terms of what SmackDown or WWE as a whole normally promotes. So perhaps it is time to call up a team that could be popular enough to face the Usos and also pose a convincing threat for those championship belts. In a backstage segment, we see Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens trying to find a partner to help them in their efforts against the New Day. They are rebuffed by Baron Corbin, who says he hates both of them, and then Bobby Roode accuses them of ruining his very first Survivor Series match ever and says both of them owe him receipts. From there, we are taken to another backstage segment where Naomi is talking to her makeup artist and is confronted by Ruby Riott, Liv Morgan, and Sarah Logan from NXT. The three NXT stars attack Naomi. Becky Lynch, of course, tries to come to Naomi's rescue, only to get an even greater beatdown. The three women slam her into a table, then slam the table on top of her, and then repeatedly slam her in a door. Presumably, this will write off Becky Lynch to go off and film The Marine Part 87,214, which is rumored to be in production soon and in which she will star. This is my thought on this. I'm excited to see new women, of course, joining the SmackDown roster as well. But having these two concurrent NXT call-up segments where there's three women debuting on each brand. Now, granted, Paige is returning to WWE, But having two trios attacking the women on each roster simultaneously doesn't feel creative or interesting. So unless these women are somehow connected with one another, I don't understand the timing of this or the fact that legitimately these two angles are playing out simultaneously in identical fashion. Did it strike anyone else as a bit redundant? It would be nice if they came in with defined motivations and some kind of a different introduction. But seriously, we had seen almost exactly this the night before, except it happened in the ring. I do look forward to where these women will be placed in the division and how they will change the landscape of challengers for the women's titles on both SmackDown and Raw. But I really strongly feel that this was poorly timed, and the sheer fact that it was two trios, it just feels repetitious, right? And I can't be the only one who was watching and thinking the same thing. In terms of the talent that was called up to each brand, I definitely think that Raw got the better deal here. The two women who've been called up from NXT onto Raw have greater experience in the ring than the three competitors who have now debuted on SmackDown, but I think that the women joining SmackDown have enough unique identities that they can really fit in and make a difference. I'll be interested specifically to see what Ruby Riott does on the brand. She has a look that is quite different than previous competitors that we've seen on SmackDown, and I look forward to seeing her interact with some of the women in the division. Elsewhere backstage, Shane McMahon talks to Daniel Bryan and says that he finally has seen the light of Daniel doing things his way, meaning that as the entire roster has beaten down Zayn and Owens later in the night, then Daniel Bryan will swoop in and fire them. He leaves the arena and goes back to the hotel to watch things go down. I bet I wasn't the only one who realized that this is going to take a shocking twist. AJ Styles is out next with the WWE World Heavyweight Championship to put over his match against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, talking about how he got congratulated by many people on social media and in person for holding his own against the Universal Champion. He then switches over to discussing Jinder Mahal, the former WWE Champion who dropped the title to AJ just a couple weeks ago on SmackDown, cuts him off, obviously, and says that they will face in the main event at WWE Clash of Champions coming in December. As AJ challenges him to come to the ring, the Singh brothers attack him from behind, but AJ manages to fight them off, standing victorious, as we now know that the next SmackDown-specific pay-per-view will be coming, and Jinder Mahal will be challenging for the WWE Championship. I will go out on a limb here to say that I firmly believe Jinder will become a two-time WWE Champion at that SmackDown pay-per-view in December. We will have to wait and see where that will lead, but that's what my gut says is going to happen. Finally, back in the ring for action, it is newly crowned WWE SmackDown Women's Champion Charlotte Flair defending against former champion Natalya. Remember, Natalya just dropped the belt to Charlotte last week in Charlotte's hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina, and they are facing off for the Women's Championship. It's a great back-and-forth co-main event, which is interrupted by the new NXT interlopers in the women's division. It's interesting to note that the crowd goes wild for these women attacking Natalya. There's a huge NXT chant during the course of their attack on Natalya, but that doesn't end things. After laying Natalya out outside the ring, the NXT chant continues even as Logan, Riott, and Morgan enter the ring to take on and lay out the women's champion Charlotte Flair. You have to note that even as the most popular female superstar on the SmackDown roster is beaten mercilessly, the NXT chant continues. I don't know if that has to do with the popularity of NXT or simply how hungry people might be to see new competitors in the women's division. By the way, has anyone else noted, I'm sure they have, the striking similarity in resemblance between Liv Morgan and WWE Hall of Famer Trish Stratus? It's like they could totally be sisters. Regardless, the women definitely make an impact on the women's roster on SmackDown. I'll be interested to see where it goes. I wish it had played out slightly differently or at a different time, but nonetheless, they are here and they are ready to make a difference. During the Lumberjack match, which is our main event featuring Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn taking on the New Day, the entire locker room surrounds the ring. Each of them is trying to get in their little pot shots at Owens and Zayn. But as one would imagine in the months leading up to the Royal Rumble, all hell breaks loose at ringside and all of the superstars end up brawling through the ring in typical fashion, allowing Owens and Zayn to steal the victory. After the match, of course, Zayn and Owens want to make haste to get away from the ring. Unfortunately, they are stopped by the New Day. Owens has just enough opportunity to make a break into the audience, but unfortunately, Sami Zayn doesn't, and the New Day take out their frustrations on poor Sami. They beat him like a redheaded stepchild. Then we go backstage where Kevin Owens confronts Daniel Bryan, saying, "You can't fire us." As the show goes off the air, Daniel reveals that he has never intended to fire Owens and Zayn, in spite of Shane's demands, saying that he in fact does recognize their talent and what they contribute to SmackDown. But then, in a turn of events, he announces that next week, Owens will be facing Randy Orton one-on-one. Owens, of course, protests, saying, "You can't do this." And then Bryan says, "Oh, I can't?" Kevin Owens backs down, setting up for next week's main event on SmackDown. It's time for a little retribution for the Viper. That is this week's Arm Drag Takedown of the Blue Brand and SmackDown Live. We now briefly turn our attentions to the Impact Wrestling Thursday night broadcast on Pop TV. It is on Thanksgiving, and I am not going to waste a great deal of time on what I feel was an utterly uneventful, completely throwaway episode of this show. I understand they don't want to advance storylines on a night that most viewers might not tune in, and they certainly don't want to throw away any of the big reveals that they have in store moving forward. But I will say that I felt completely lackluster in terms of my interest and level of desire to see any of the flashbacks to former episodes broadcasting on Thanksgiving. I don't give a damn which of the former superstars they've had or misused to make them wear this turkey suit. I'm going to cut it short. We spend a lot of time with superstars telling us ridiculous stories about Thanksgiving and then end up in a 5-on-5 match with the winner, or rather with the losing party, being forced to wear a turkey costume. It comes down to Chris Adonis being pinned and forced into the turkey costume for 2017. He gets it half on, then decides to bow out, only to have security for the first time in the history of professional wrestling actually able to stop him, return him to the ring, and he is forced to dress as a turkey. In the end, everyone ends up in a massive, colossal food fight, which goes off the air with Chris Adonis attempting to throw a pie, and instead of hitting its intended target, clocks global champion Eli Drake in the face. Whew! I want my 2 hours back, you guys. I want my 2 hours back, and I can't wait for next week when we get to see a return to storylines that have been started in the past couple weeks. Post Bound for Glory, we've already gone over how excited I was to see Fala Ba challenge for EC3's Grand Championship. He had a great showing last week, and I really feel that the future is bright for Fala Ba. We did get to see him compete in this big 5-on-5 match, which bodes well for him. We also got information about the upcoming Knockouts Championship Tournament. It will have a total of 6 knockouts competing for the newly vacated championship, which was left without a champion when Gail Kim retired. Fala Ba is, I see great things for him. Also, it looks like we might be seeing more from KM, and if they will only incorporate Kongo Kong into upcoming storylines, I'll be a happy, happy camper. I don't want anyone who's listening to think that this is hating on Impact Wrestling. Impact is not the only one who has traditionally done horrible Thanksgiving shows. Back in the day, we've seen things like SummerSlam have the gobbledygooker on Thanksgiving. So this is not exclusive to Impact. I just wish that they had a different night of broadcasting so we could have possibly seen new storylines as they continue to advance and develop. In the interim, I'll wait for next week. Fingers crossed we get Falaba and Congo Kong. I don't know why I love these guys so much. Congo Kong is very interesting. I'm a big fan of the classic monster heels in professional wrestling, and Congo Kong fits that to the T, and Falaba is just friggin' hilarious. Go check him out. Look up Pro Wrestling Syndicate and see what the guy can do when he's given a chance. Impact Wrestling seems to have changed their perspective on him, and I am optimistic that a program against EC3 could move him into greater acceptance and embrace by the Impact viewing community and do bigger things for him in the long run. I feel that he and Mario Baccara have been misused as a tag team for weeks and weeks and months now. I think that they should have been brought in as legitimate contenders, because God knows the current tag team division in Impact is pretty dreadful. They would have been a welcome addition, but they were misused. Now, if Falaba can get his opportunity on a solo front, I'll be a little bit happier. That is my arm drag takedown, albeit a brief one, of this week's Impact Wrestling Thursday night Thanksgiving broadcast. When we come back, we will have with us Lucha Underground superstar Cobra Moon, also known as Thunder Rosa on the independent circuit. She is going to talk intergender matches, the evolution of women's wrestling. I refuse to call it the revolution because that's so passe at this point. The evolution of women's wrestling, as well as Lucha Underground Season 4 and what she hopes to see happen when it returns to El Rey Network next year. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. Find, follow, and like Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar on Facebook and Twitter. Like Arm Drag Takedown on Facebook at facebook.com/ADT with PDM. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/ADT with PDM. That's ADT with PDM. Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good.
I appreciate you talking to me today and sharing your experience in professional wrestling.
Well, I'm excited. I haven't done one in a little while. People got tired of talking to me.
Oh, well. Well, I just got the opportunity to meet you for the very first time, so I'm not tired of talking to you at all.
No, perfect. This is, I think, well, your podcast is for a different type of crowd, or is it also, you say it was for wrestling and other stuff, right?
Oh, it's all pro wrestling. It just happens to be, you know, hosted by a drag queen.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a little different. I'd say it's a little different. I haven't been interviewed by a drag queen ever.
By the way, I want to say that it was super exciting because you were on the very first show where I ever took a major bump. I was so excited after that Wrestling for Charity show, and I got to do my whole in-ring thing with Jekylls, and you guys were so awesome in the back. I loved it. Thank you.
No, thank you for having us. It was really good for me to go back home to the Bay Area.
You've wrestled, I know, all over the world, basically. And how did you first get into wrestling?
I was living in Oakland. I had a regular job. I didn't have nothing to do. Donovan Troy actually had my husband and I inviting us. He invited us to, like, shows, like local shows, but we never really went. So we ended up going to a show called Hoodlum at first, and we kind of got hooked because he was, like, completely different than the regular wrestling that I used to watch with him before. And then my friend was like, you should come to APW, which was in Hayward back then. And then I was like, okay, let's see, because he was the ring announcer. So we ended up going, but he was in there. And then they had a tryout. I went to the tryout, and I was like, I think I can do this. And I did. That's how I got started.
It's funny because most people kind of like grow up sort of having the idea that they want to do wrestling, and you sort of fell into it.
Yeah, well, I had no intention whatsoever to become a wrestler in my life. I never thought about, you know, being slumming myself with a mat for a living. You know, I wanted to be a teacher. I was actually working on getting my master's degree. I had the application. Everything was ready to go. And then this happened. And then I left my... I still have the application ready to be sent to Cal State East Bay.
Well, just in case, you know, just in case things change. Or down the road.
Yeah, I might switch my major, though. I don't think I want to do social work anymore. But yeah, totally.
You could always be like, listen, you are either going to sign up for general assistance or I'm going to put you in a sleeper chokehold.
Pretty much. I think now it will become a lot easier if I had to work with, like, in like a hospital or something like that. Yeah, I wouldn't feel so afraid, let's say.
And how is it that you got involved? I know that you wrestled locally in the Bay Area for a while, but how is it that you became involved with Lucha Underground?
I got scouted at a show in Los Angeles. This show was organized by a promotion that I worked in Japan. They brought it for the first time to Los Angeles. They were looking for girls because they didn't have a lot of girls. And my name was mentioned by some of my peers down there. So a couple of the writers and the executive producer came to see the show, and they introduced themselves to me after my match. You know, it was very charming. I honestly didn't know who they were, so I didn't know what they were for, whatever they're for, but, you know, whatever. They gave me the card. They're like, oh, call us after the weekend. It's over. So I did call them, and they were like, yeah, we're interested in bringing you over, and that was it, right? And then I waited 3 weeks or so, and then all of a sudden I got a contract. That's how I got started. I thought I was going to have to do a tryout, a match or anything. No, it was like they went and scouted for girls. They liked me, and they signed me.
Wow.
That's how I ended up at Lucha Underground.
Now, Lucha Underground is something so very different than what we see in most of traditional wrestling. I mean, you talk about Hood Slam kind of getting you hooked in a way, because Hood Slam is very, very different. But in terms of televised wrestling products, Lucha Underground is extremely different than what we see, whether it's the kind of supernatural elements to it or the characters which we see. What are your thoughts on the product as a whole?
I love it. I mean, it's completely different. Like, we explore things that are, like, supernatural, and, like, a lot of us have, like, supernatural powers, and we do things that in a regular TV show that you can't really have. And it's really, like, dark and raw in terms of, like, how violent it is.
Yeah, very
much. In many ways. So I like that part. And the fact that you have, like, a storyline and you have tribes, so it's not only, like, the group A, group B, is like, the tribe, and all of them have, like long history. You know, so, like, for example, Cobra Moon had, like, huge history. She was reborn after the whole entire tribe was wiped out because Drago, my slave right now, he betrayed us. And my guardians, which was Ibora and Pindar, they saved my DNA. So I reincarnated in another person because they saved me, and now I'm looking for revenge. So, I mean, tell me who in the WWE got reincarnated and they saved their DNA. Nobody.
Yeah, well,
so I think that's really cool.
The product, I love it because we've always said, or people who love professional wrestling try to, when you describe why you love it to other people, they don't quite understand it. And then you can say, like, well, it's like a soap opera, but Lucha Underground takes it to a whole new level. It's like a telenovela. It's something completely different.
Yeah, you got drama, you get action, people get killed. Yeah, it's just like telenovela. Like, people get killed, they resurrect after, I don't know, they had a twin. So, that's like stories like that. And I think it's like a new twist to Lucha Libre.
Yeah.
But with a more, like, cinematographic point of view, I think. And that's what makes it so much different.
Is it, being a Latina, did you watch Lucha Libre when you were growing up?
A little bit. I wasn't like an avid, you know, follower of Lucha Libre. I mean, it was on TV, so I knew like the big names like Mascarita Sagrada, or Octagon,
well, La Parca. Conan, of course, he was so popular because he used to sing, he used to act. So he was in a lot of stuff on TV. So for me, he was, you know, he was mainstream. But no, dude, I didn't really watch a show until I was 18. Like a live show.
Wow.
So,
okay.
It's been a learning experience. It's like, I've said it many times. English is my second language, and wrestling is my third or fourth. So I had to learn it from scratch. I didn't know no moving, no nothing.
It's something that I think that so many people, like I said, it's something that they've loved since very early on, and they grow up with the intention of doing it, so they are more educated even when they start training, and you fell in love with it or fell into it later in life. And has it been a difficult learning curve for you?
Yes, it has been, because fortunately and unfortunately, I've been put in situations in where it's like learning by fire, you know, so it's like either you learn it or you're going to fail, like completely fail. That's what I'm talking about. When I went, my first time I went to Japan, I was not even 3 months in business. They sent me to Japan. Then I had to learn their style out there. I had to learn a new language. I had to learn, like, lucha libre. Because I was Mexican, they put me on lucha libre matches. I don't know any psychology on lucha libre. And I was forced to learn really, really quick. Because I had to do the match, that style, you know, so that. So it was that. Then I come back to the United States and then like relearn everything else again, because everything in Japan, lucha, and American, some of the styles are different, so I have to relearn it again. And then I get involved in lucha underground. I have to learn how to wrestle lucha libre style with my, you know, my basics in American style. Then what else? I don't know. There's been occasions where I'm like, holy crap, like, fake until you make it. So that's when I learned that it's more important sometimes to work your character than to do, like, all this crazy fancy moves in the ring. Because that's what's going to get you over more than anything else. So I had to, like, heavily rely on my ability to connect with the fans and my ability to act and react to what they were looking for. Yeah, it's been really challenging, but it's rewarding at the same time.
How is it that you ended up getting called to tour in Japan so early? Japanese tours tend to be something that most American-based professional wrestlers look at as a long-term goal. I mean, that's something that they all want to do, and you got called upon to do it so very early.
I was at the right place at the right time, and the person that was in charge of sending girls to Japan wasn't able to get people on time because, like, you know, a lot of people didn't get their passport. So she called me. She gave me a month to get my passport. I literally dropped everything that I was doing, drove 10 hours to San Diego to get my passport, and then had to drive 10 hours back. And then told my boss, by the way, I need 3 months off. So that was working full time. Like, I have, like, a month off worth of PTO, but I need 2 more months. So what's up? I want to wrestle in Japan, my dreams. And they were very supportive. They let me go, you know, and that's how it happened. Because that was one of my goals. It was like, there were two goals that I had when I started. It was to go to Japan and then to go to Mexico. 3 months in, I was able to go to Japan. When I came back, I met one of the luchadores over there. I made arrangements. I went to Mexico. That same week, that's when I got booked in Lucha Underground. But everything happened within like a year of me becoming a professional wrestler. So I was in a position where I was like, oh my God, if I keep going like this, I'm not going to be able to have a regular job. It's either I have a regular job or I become a full-time professional wrestler. And that's a sacrifice that I did. I became a professional wrestler and quit my job.
Yeah, I'm sitting here and I've actually got my mouth is sort of hanging open because you are the exact opposite of what we so often hear. You know what I mean? Like, all of this happens so fast for you. Most of the time, wrestlers spend a number of years driving and driving and driving to shows and hoping to get a break, and everything just fell in place for you so fast.
Yes, but I was willing to do the sacrifice, and my partner, my husband. If I didn't have him, I don't think I would have been able to do half of the stuff that I have done. because you have to have a really strong support system that not only supports you economically, but they also believe in you and then help you throughout the way, because it's so hard to be away from home, you know, especially when you have a partner. It's so hard to, like, be in a place where you don't know anybody, you don't know the language, you don't know the customs, you don't know things, and it's just, like, it's very difficult. And, like, I am blessed that my husband is, he, from day one, it was like, he's the one who, both of us look at each other, we're like, if we don't do this in this amount of time, you're going to go back to work. And I was like, okay, we're not going to do this. But we had a feeling that we were going to go further than anybody else had. And for me, being an immigrant, being from Mexico, and coming to the United States, that's like my goal. My goal is to live the American dream, to say, like, oh, I did all this stuff because the doors were open for me, regardless of my, you know, immigration status or whatever. It's because somebody saw something, I work hard, and I kept in, and I work even harder to keep the position that I earned. You know, there's so many hungry people behind you, and you have to work three times as hard to keep what you have. Because, you know, there's always somebody younger, somebody cuter, somebody with bigger moves that do the same moves that you do, but you have to make sure that people want you because you have something special.
Yeah, it's fantastic that your husband is so supportive. It's something that repeatedly we hear about, especially careers in professional wrestling, pull couples apart because of the time that they're separated from because of travel or, you know, various reasons, egos. I don't know what it is, but, you know, there's always something. But it's wonderful to hear that you have a partner that's so supportive of you.
Yeah, and I mean, it is hard now. Like, even when I just, like, little 10 days away or 5 days away, just, like, and you just come back, because it takes a toll after a while. I mean, in the last 2 years, I've been traveling. I've been away from home probably like 9 months, 10 months.
Wow.
Counting like small tours that I've done. Because no matter what, like, even though, like, I'm signed for Lucha Underground, I still have to go to places and make a name for myself, because that's a lot of people that don't know who I am. And I'm really, really, like, I have my head on my shoulders, and I'm not like, well, I already did this. No, there's even more work to do, because we're not on mainstream media. It's like on El Rey Network and on Netflix. Yeah, we're on Netflix, but still, a lot of people don't watch wrestling on Netflix. But still, there's a lot more work for me to do, and there's a lot of more goals that I have for next year and the following year for me to accomplish, and I will accomplish them, but it's going to take a little time and patience.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the unfortunate situation for you really is that of the people who are on Lucha Underground that are able to be recognized, like, I think of people like Brian Cage or Paul London, people who are not wrestling in a mask, who are allowed to build their character in a visible way. Cobra Moon is part of a great storyline, but you're under a mask, so nobody really recognizes that it's you, per se.
You're absolutely right. So that's why, like, now that they let us use the character outside, I try to, like, tell promoters that I'm allowed to use it and they can use it. But it's up to them if they want to use it or not. But again, because I have that platform in my career, and I'm using that to, like, parachute myself to do bigger things as Thunder Rosa too. So people know me and they know how I work. Because I don't wrestle on TV. I'm a manager. So sometimes it's kind of hard to, like, translate that I'm a good wrestler into, like, that being a manager. But, you know, I take whatever, if they give me lemons, I'm going to make a lemonade. So I made a really good lemonade in season 3. And people like the character, so that's good.
I remember when you first made your debut on Lucha Underground, slithering around and whatnot, and I was wondering how it is that you... I'm sure that they wrote it well for you, but how did you kind of discover and get familiar with who Cobra Moon is as a character?
Yeah, it was just like hit and miss. Like, okay, I will do certain things to see if it worked. But I was advised to really create a character, something more that had more substance to it than just wrestling. So we have a lot of wrestlers there. So that's why we were like, okay, you should do this, you should do that. And I'll put it, you know, I put everything together. And then that was on season 1. But, you know, they didn't really tell me that much information about character, like background information or anything. They're very secretive on their characters, because there's a lot of people that like to talk about it. weeks when they're not supposed to. So that's probably why. But, you know, I work with what I had again, and, you know, people kind of knew who she was. Season three, when I was giving more information, more background, and then we do the vignettes, and, like, they created all these, like, super cool stage for Cobra Moon with, like, the throne and everything. I was like, so cool, like, 1950s kind of style stuff. And then I had my, like, legion of reptiles. I was like, oh, my God. And then I got to, like, drag Drago, who's one of the most, like, iconic wrestlers, like, contemporary wrestlers now in AAA. It was an honor for me to work with these people, you know, because they're, like, veterans, and I learned so much from them. So for me, it's been, like, very empowering, and then very I'm learning as I go on how to develop a character and how to get it over even more, you know. So, and then I get to act, too, which is, like, something that you don't get to do as often, because you get to wrestle, not to act as much like that. So, I don't know. I really do like where this is going. And with season four, I'm, like, crossing my fingers that we have a bigger impact in the temple.
It's to your credit that you're able to get your character over the way you are. Because, again, with a mask, there's no such thing as real extreme facial expressions or any of that. You've got some limitations placed on you. So the fact that your body language and the storylines are able to connect with audiences is a real credit to you as a performer.
Thank you. I still need to work on it. But yeah, I'm just putting, like, all the things that I've learned throughout the years, you know, all the things that that I gathered when I was, like, a student in high school, because I do theater out there, and things that I've seen from luchadors and some great technical luchadors. But again, like you were saying, they're wearing a mask, so you can't really see any expression. But, like, the fact that I was able to communicate with my body, that says a lot.
I really enjoy Lucha Underground in huge part because, having grown up personally obsessed with professional wrestling, I read about so many of these fantastic luchadors that wrestled in Mexico, but I did get to see, when I was growing up, we had a satellite dish. This is so even before cable, right? So we had a satellite dish, and I would get to see these amazing Lucha Libre matches, but because I didn't speak Spanish fluently, I didn't know what was being said. So I just got to watch them in the ring tell a story. And I love the fact that with Lucha Underground, I get to be exposed to these fantastic wrestlers who have done such amazing things in Mexico and have it told in story fashion that I, as an English-speaking fan, get to understand and appreciate. It's so incredible.
And that's exactly why they created Lucha Underground the way that they created it, because they wanted to market Lucha Libre to a Anglo-Saxon non-Lucha Libre community, you know, and make it mainstream. And I think it is possible if we continue doing this, and if this TV show gets more views and it is more available for more people, I think people will understand what we're talking about.
I definitely think that it's making people stars in the U.S. market that would not have been stars necessarily here. I mean... We've seen it, for example, even with a number of the names that have gone on and participated in Impact Wrestling after, you know, Drago, for example. Drago is there, has been there. Tejano is, you know, Tejano, I had read about Tejano and Tejano Jr. for years in professional wrestling magazines, or Dr. Wagner Jr. And Lucha Underground has brought these people to my television and allowed me to see and appreciate them. And I have to say, Vampiro is so friggin' good in terms of providing, like, a history lesson. You know what I mean? It's so impactful to educate people to what Lucha is about, and Vampiro is amazing at doing that.
Yeah, he's worked Lucha for quite a bit. He's been in the business for a long time, and, you know, he's known a lot of people, and he's worked with along the line with a lot of the big stars in Mexico, so he's one of the good people to, like, tell a good story, especially when he's narrating stuff in during the show. But that's one of, actually one of my goals, talking about history. It just came to my in my head that I really want to learn, like, on my own, because I've like, read and, you know, seen some documentaries and stuff like that, you know, the history of Lucha Libre. Because that's, like, part of my culture. You know, I'm Mexican. I was born and raised in Mexico. And when I went to Mexico City the first time, like, I was just in awe of, like, how deep Lucha Libre is in our culture, especially for, our, like, the low-income families and, like, the entertainment that brings to communities like that and like, the impact that it can do on people's lives in general.
Well, I have always appreciated the fact that, in fact, I was educating somebody who is involved in the professional wrestling industry about the concept of exoticos. Exoticos have always played such a prominent role in Lucha Libre. And as a person who's a member of the LGBTQ community and a drag performer, we don't have that in American culture the same way that exoticos, for example, are portrayed and even embraced in Latin culture in terms of Lucha Libre.
That's true. And that's another argument that I actually, I was having somebody, and I was just telling them how I appreciate that in Mexican culture, where you have, like, huge stars that are exotico, that, you know, they don't have to hide, you know, their sexual preferences in the ring. They just, you know, use that even for their own character, you know, so, and that has taken them, like, so many places, and like, I really enjoy that, because I think that's one of the most fun parts of Lucha Libre. Exotico and the minis.
Yeah, the minis are definitely, the minis, it's, those are both things that are so embraced as part of Lucha that we don't see in American-based professional wrestling. And minis are treated totally differently in American-based wrestling.
Yeah, they are.
One of the things that really stands out about Lucha Underground are the intergender matches that they have promoted and the way that they present women on equal footing in many capacities as the men. And I was wondering if you, as a female wrestler, would talk about the impact you think that that's having in the industry.
I think now, well, still people, some promotions don't like intergender wrestling at all. They think it's just, like, not believable.
Right.
And that women shouldn't wrestle men. I personally like the fact that we are able to be seen as equals, because we both are athletes and we both can pretty much do the same stuff. I personally, my husband and I, after, you know, doing this for 3 years, we started our own promotion. So we actually have shows that are only nothing but intergender matches, because we believe that it's important for people to see that women and men can be on the ring and they can wrestle each other, and we can be believable. You know, I think I'm really thankful that Lucha Underground gives us the platform to show this on TV so more people can see that.
They've certainly done in Lucha Underground amazing things in terms of Sexy Star. They've portrayed her in a way that is believable. She's, you know, always portrayed as an underdog, but she's got this fighting spirit and she won't let, you know, the men dictate her level of success, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect story to tell.
How familiar are you with what happened between her and Rosemary? That made such huge headlines. It was so shocking.
I mean, it's just kind of, it's just, like, I honestly really sucks, but, you know, it is what it is. It happened, like, what I said before. One day, you're a hero on social media, and the next day, you're a villain.
Yeah.
You know, and somebody will get benefits, and somebody will lose a lot of stuff. So that's what happened, pretty much. Very unfortunate.
Yeah, I don't know what went into it, but it was certainly made her very well known and not necessarily probably the way she would have liked. Now, Lucha Underground was just greenlit, and it was just announced a couple of weeks ago that you guys are coming back for a season 4. And you've already kind of indicated that you hope that your tribe of serpents is more prominently featured. What would you like to see explored with your character that may not have been?
I'd definitely like to explore more of, like, the evil side of her. I mean, it was shown in the last episode that, you know, if you mess with Cobra Moon, you can either get beheaded or die in some really awful way. So I'd like to, like, explore more of, like, the power relations between her and, like, Gaga, because now she has a king. But I would like to see that not only in vignette, but probably, too, on the ring. I think that would be very interesting. I don't know. I'd like to see more, like, if she tries to, like, if she tries to build an army to, like, retake what is hers and what it belongs to, is, like, the snake tribe, because we were the most dominant tribe in the temple. So I would like to see, hopefully, and, like, hopefully, I don't know, it's just, like, speculations of things that I would like to happen, that happen, that I can, like, create mayhem and start, you know, converting people into, like, snakes and stuff like that. I don't know. That would be cool. That would be different.
The interesting thing about it, of course, is that you could pretty much say anything, and because of the way the stories are told, anything that you could imagine being possible is possible in Lucha Underground, unlike what happens in other wrestling organizations. You know, I love that. I love the fact that Katrina pops in and out. I love the fact that Mil Muertes dies and comes back to life. I love the fact that anything truly is possible in Lucha Underground in a way that it's not otherwise.
Yes.
Places.
Yes, I can't wait.
One of the things that I definitely feel you touched upon earlier in this interview, and you said, for example, when you were in Japan, you said that you had to really rely much more on your character than even your in-ring skills, because the character is what helps people connect with the with the performer. In Lucha Underground, everybody is so incredibly skilled. Like, their athletics are unquestionable. But it's the characters that make the stories so compelling. I mean, the matches are, I don't even know, just insane to watch. But the characters are what make people stand out, because everybody can do backflips and 450s, but the characters are so unique.
Yes. And I think that's the most important part for people to keep watching the show.
So
they feel connected to the characters.
So you mentioned that you've got some more goals that you have in mind for the next year or two, and I want to know what those are.
So let's start with professional-wise. I want to return to Europe, work with bigger companies that I didn't work out there. See, I want to go to Australia. Hopefully, now that apparently, like, again, it's all a speculation of whatever I read online. If they allow us to work in other places, I would love to work for ROH, for Women of Honor. Right now that is, you know, been very popular. Do some stuff out there. I think that would be great exposure for me as a wrestler. Go back to Mexico and work with some of the legends out there, some of the women that, you know, that's worked out there. I love Lady Apache and Rosy Moreno. I think they're great. And every time I see them, they teach me something new. So I cannot wait to go out there and see what they're going to teach me. Make our company a little bit bigger in terms of, here in Texas for women's wrestling. We're working on that. We're trying to, like, run instead of 4 shows, 6 shows a year in 2 different cities. We don't know yet, but it's on the works. And lastly, I think I want to focus on working on bigger companies in the next 2 years, and work on many opponents that are, you know, that are going to hit, they're popular right now. That's what I want to say.
Tell me a little bit about running your own company in Texas.
It's different. It is a little harder than California, because California seems like they love women's wrestling. And here is, like, we are re-educating people about wrestling and the roles that women have now in this business. January will be our 3rd show. This will be an intergender show, which is going to be the 1st intergender show in the history of Texas. Please send us your blessings. Because I know it's going to be good, but, like, again, we're, like, educating people on how good women's wrestling is becoming, and how much and how hard women are working to earn the places that they have. It is interesting. Little by little, we're making a difference, and we're working with the community to try to get sponsors and do something different, you know. We're just trying to do our best for people to know our brand.
But you've been in the industry such a short period of time. You've traveled all over the world. You've been on television. You've got your own promotion. I'm listening to this sort of like checklist. This is stuff that people generally take 10 or more years to do, and you've done it in a handful.
Yeah.
What is it that makes you so driven?
I've always been like that since I was a young girl. Like, very independent and, like, always wanted to do more and be different and that. And with the wrestling, it's just like an empty canvas. I was like, oh, I can do this? Oh, okay, how do I do it? Okay. And I'll be good at that. Oh, how do I do it? Oh, okay, let me go that way, you know? So, like, just like I said, I was at the right place at the right time. And I knew the right people, and an opportunity just appeared in there. Like, hey, you have to risk this much. Are you done with it? And I was like, okay, hold on. And then I asked my husband, what do you think? And he's just as crazy as I am. I gotta do it. So now we've been running our female promotion called Sabotage for like the last year and a couple months. So that's how we did it. It's just like we're taking like huge risks that I know that if we never took them, like we will be regretting it.
People know Cobra Moon. Tell us what the Thunder Rosa character is.
Yeah, a lot of people know my character, Thunder Rosa, before they knew Cobra Moon. Like right now, with the creators that on the Underground, I have been able to promote my own brand, which is Thunder Rosa. People really like it because Thunder Rosa is pretty much like huge underdog that never gives up. No matter what happened, no matter how many problems she has, she always comes forward. For me, the Thunder Rosa character is a celebration of life. As you know, the date of death is a celebration of life once you pass away. And it started when I was working in a rehab facility with a ton of kids in dangerous circumstances. And a lot of them committed suicide. Or they get killed by the police, or drugs and alcohol to their life. So every time I get in the ring, or every time I lay down, I think about them and think about all the sacrifices that the parents did and the sacrifices that I've done. And when I get in the ring, it's like I remember them, and I know that if they can see me, they will be very proud that I'm living my dreams. Like I told them one time, I remember I woke them up because I used to supervise like 47 kids, and I woke up the girls in it, and I told them, "Guess what, girls?" And they're like, "What?" I'm gonna become a wrestler. And they're like, "You're crazy!" You know, watch me like a year, and I did. And actually, the place I used to work, it was called Thunder Road, so we took that to make Thunder Rosa. So it was Thunder Rosa, and that's how it was created.
Wow, powerful story.
Yeah, and the funny part is, like, a lot of my coworkers, they hit me up on Facebook now, and then they're like, "I remember when you first told me you were going to be a wrestler, and now I see you on TV." It's like the craziest thing ever. Yeah, but again, you can't give up when you have a goal and you have a dream. And like I said, I just can't give up. There's days that I'm like, I'm just not quit. Because it's like, I'm done. Like, just too much. You sacrifice too much. Sometimes you don't see, you know, the reward. But then when stuff starts happening to you and good things start happening to you and you see the good that you do, that goes away. The stuff goes out the window.
Well, Thunder Rosa, thank you so much, Melissa, for talking. I appreciate it. And I'm super excited. I hope we get to work together again soon in Wrestling for Charity. And I'm excited to watch you on season 4 of Lucha Underground and follow Sabotage as well.
So thank you for inviting me to your podcast. Your questions about Lucha Underground were really good. I'm glad you like the product.
Oh, I love it. I do. The in-ring product stands on its own, but the storytelling, as a person who values good quality storytelling and continuity of stories, I don't see what I see in Lucha Underground anywhere else.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Once again, that was Lucha Underground star Cobra Moon, who wrestles on the indie circuit under the moniker Thunder Rosa. Follow Thunder Rosa on Twitter. It's Thunder Rosa, THUNDERROSA, and then the number 22, Thunder Rosa 22. Thank you, Thunder Rosa, for joining us on episode 7 of Arm Drag Takedown with Poyo Del Mar. I am Poyo Del Mar, and we are rapidly coming to a close of this episode. I would like to give a quick shout out to WWE legend Kamala James Harris, who is currently hospitalized, his medical conditions are worsening, and we do not know how long this legend will be with us. You are in my thoughts, Kamala. I remember watching you long before your days in the WWE when you were a superstar in the Mid-South Wrestling Organization, which was so close to my home in Texas. By the way, that's where Thunder Rosa lives, in Houston specifically, and that's where I kind of grew up as well. So, Kamala, you are in my thoughts. From everyone here at Arm Drag Takedown who's listening, please send good, positive energy Kamala's way. Meanwhile, remember, follow Arm Drag Takedown on Twitter and like us on Facebook. You can find this podcast at ADT with PDM. We will be back next episode with another Arm Drag Takedown of all of our favorite television products relating to the world of professional wrestling, as well as yet another celebrity interview. I have an idea of who it's going to be, but I don't want to say just yet because I don't want to jinx it. However, if I have my way, fingers crossed, he is going to be a two-time world heavyweight champion. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week with all of that and more. Until then, my name is Poyo Del Mar. Stick a fork in me, honey, because like this podcast, I am done.